A research biologist and cancer survivor, Sandra Steingraber was inspired to activism by the classic book Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, becoming one of America's leading environmental writers and anti-pollution advocates. Steingraber has now edited the Library of America edition of Carson's writings, an unprecedented collection of letters, speeches, and other writings that reveal the extraordinary courage and vision of its author. The volume presents one of the landmark books of the 20th century, Silent Spring, together with rare letters, speeches, and other writings that reveal the personal courage and passionate commitment of its author. Sandra Steingraber is the distinguished scholar in residence at Ithaca College, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Sandra, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What brought you to this project? Obviously, you have been a fan of Rachel Carson's work for a long time. What brought you to edit her work and put it together in a volume?
Well, the Library of America collects the writings of iconic American writers and puts them in print in these beautiful volumes that never go out of print. And it for a writer, it's like receiving your star in Hollywood for an actor. And so I was just thrilled and honored when Library of America asked me to edit this collection, which represents a reissue of her landmark book, Silent Spring, as well as letters that she wrote to her fellow scientists showing her mind at work as she gathered the data for this book, as well as love letters, letters at the end of her life when she was dying of breast cancer, worried she wouldn't be able to finish the book, and then finally speeches that she gave. You know, Silent Spring won every possible award from both scientific societies as well as literary societies, and she used the occasion of her acceptance speeches to really push back against her enemies in the chemical industry who sought to discredit her and counter her very good science with a lot of disinformation. So she's really having a moment right now, Rachel Carson, for our time, as someone who was writing about environmental destruction out of the dark and paranoid era of the Cold War, above ground nuclear bomb testing, McCarthyism. She was a very brave voice, and lots of people seem to be rediscovering her as a portrait of courage that we need in this moment that we find ourselves today.
Talk a little bit about what went into the impetus for the book. The book was published in the fall of 1962, Silent Spring. What was her impetus and really the driving force in her life to want to take on this project?
Well, Rachel Carson was an amazing scientist, first and foremost, as well as being a lovely writer. And she brought both her skills in poetry and her skills as a biologist to this project, but it certainly did represent a point of departure for her. And when she sat down to begin this book, she was already a best-selling author, known as a beautiful nature writer who mostly focused on the ocean. She had a trilogy of books about the sea in which her writer's voice really served as a submarine camera that took us below the waves and showed us a world that no one had ever seen before, right? Because these books were written at a time before we had Nova specials and actual real-life cameras that could go underwater and reveal this world to us. So she did that through writing. And her philosophy really was if she could make her readers inculcate a sense of wonder and awe at the natural world, their lust for destruction, as she put it, would abate and they would be invested in protecting it. In the meantime, as a government scientist in the employ of the Fish and Wildlife Service, she began to be aware that pesticides that had been used during World War II as weapons of war were now being declassified and sold to housewives, to farmers. They were being added to babies' blankets to mothproof them and to floor wax to kill flies on contact. And she had knowledge and had gathered evidence for the harm that these pesticides do both to wildlife and to people. So even though at that point she had already been able to retire as a government scientist and pursue her writing life full time, she was still gathering string on all this evidence and began to become increasingly alarmed. She didn't want to write the book herself. She kept trying to find other writers to do it. But at some point, it became a moment of, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? So she was assisted in her work. And I had fun pulling this correspondence together. She was assisted in her work by activists of the day, organized as the Committee Against Mass Poisoning, who were trying to stop the broadcast spraying from airplanes of pesticides like DDT. And they were filing a lawsuit, and because of that, were able to shake loose data from industry, from obscure corners of the government, and promised to provide it to Rachel Carson as she wrote her book. So even though Silent Spring is really and rightfully seen as a book that launched the modern American environmental movement, I argue in my introduction to this new collection from Library of America that activism actually opened up a critical space for Carson to write this book and provided her lots of evidence and data that she would not have otherwise had access to. So the relationship between science and activism is really a reciprocal one when it comes to the environmental movement and this amazing book, Silent Spring.
And I'd also like to talk about the relationship between the science and literature, because she took this incredible body of very technical and scientific evidence and made it into a gorgeous piece of literature.
Exactly, yeah. She really wove a spell, and she knew very well that all the evidence in the world that would reveal how the misuse of pesticides was really a violation of our human rights, an exercise in toxic trespass in which we were all being poisoned by inherently toxic chemicals without our consent, that in order to keep people turning the pages about a book with a warning as dark as the one that she was offering, and with as much organic chemistry as she needed to lay out, she needed to create a narrative. She needed metaphor and imagery. She needed characters, and she did it. And so for me, also, as a PhD biologist who makes my living as a science writer, I look at her work as one carpenter might look at a master carpenter's work, asking myself, how did she do that? How does she move from this telescopic, panoramic kind of view of entire ecosystems? And her writer's eye will then zoom down into, you know, the egg of an owl to look at how fetal development is being sabotaged. So she moves from the microscopic to the whole ecosystems, and there's a dynamic flow of events in her book that she's a model for me, but she's also in some ways a counter model. Rachel Carson was keeping a lot of secrets about her own life that she didn't allow anyone to know about either in real life or in her writing. So the first person I, the autobiographical impulse, does not appear in Carson's work, whereas I feel free to weave that into my own science writing. I believe that 30 years of feminism that lies between my life and Carson makes it possible for me to be more disclosing. For example, both Rachel Carson and I have in our lives a cancer diagnosis. She kept that absolutely a state secret, concerned that her enemies in industry would use that knowledge about her to impeach her science, whereas I've been very open about my own life as a cancer patient, you know, openly saying, okay, here's the evidence for the link between cancer and the environment. I am one data point in this cluster of cancers right here in this zip code. I also have my enemies in industry, but nobody's used the fact of me being a cancer patient to try to say somehow my science isn't objective. And Carson did suffer from that fear. At the same time she was writing this book, her emotional support through it all was her partner and beloved, a woman named Dorothy Freeman. And their relationship also was kept very much on the lowdown. And yet some of the most beautiful writing that is in this new collection from Library of America are in the letters that she wrote to Dorothy. Some of these are love letters, but many times she also reveals her fears and her sense of despair when things aren't going well. So you can see her writer's mind and heart at work here. And then other times she actually tries out some science on Dorothy, because Dorothy loved nature just as much as Rachel. That was part of their bond together. They were neighbors up in Maine where they both had summer cottages and they spent their time there. Whereas Carson brought a scientist's eye to all this, Dorothy was not a scientist. So that made Dorothy a perfect reader for Rachel, who wanted to write about science for other nature-loving members of the public who weren't necessarily scientists. And so Dorothy was served as a first reader for Rachel. So pulling together some of that correspondence was a real labor of love for me as well.
Sandra Steingraber is the editor of the new collection, Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, and Other Writings on the Environment, which is published by Library of America. I'm hoping you could share one of those correspondences that she had with between Rachel and Dorothy.
Sure. So this is a letter in 1958. So she was now in the thick of writing Silent Spring, and she wanted to explain why she had moved beyond the sort of reverential mode of her earlier books and now was writing in a more critical way. And she reveals to Dorothy in this correspondence that it's the sheer folly and terror of the arms race, which was going on in earnest then, was a significant factor in her new book project. So this is what she wrote. "I suppose my thinking began to be affected soon after the atomic science was firmly established. Some of the thoughts that came to me were so unattractive that I rejected them completely. But the old ideas die hard. It was comforting to suppose that the stream of life would flow on through time in whatever course that God had appointed it, without interference by one of the drops of the stream, man, and to suppose that, however the physical environment might mold life, that life could never assume the power to change drastically or even destroy the physical world. These beliefs have almost been part of me for as long as I have thought about such things. To have them even vaguely threatened was so shocking that, as I have said, I shut my mind, refused to acknowledge what I couldn't help seeing. But that does no good, and I now have opened my eyes and my mind. I may not like what I see, but it does no good to ignore it. So it seems time that someone wrote of life in the light of the truth as it now appears to us." I love that passage because I think it speaks to our moment now as we confront the climate emergency, and we're caught between wanting to deny the science and deny the empirical evidence of this unfolding tragedy all around it, and then realizing that once we know, we can't not know. And once knowing, we have a responsibility to act. And Carson, of course, went through a very parallel process in her own thinking as a naturalist when confronted with the reality that human beings had created atomic weaponry, which could wipe out all of the Earth. And it was a huge shift in her own thinking.
It seems an inevitable question, of course, as you're reading this, as I was reading her writings, was, well, what would she make of what is happening today? But as you say, there is a parallel. There was a despair then, and of course there would be a despair now.
Well, that's right, and Silent Spring was the antidote to that despair then, and it worked, right? It moved millions of people to action. Not just public-minded citizens, but also our political leaders. It moved President Kennedy to form a task force. She met with his science advisors. She testified before the Senate. And the picture on the back of the book jacket, this new edition from Library of America, I'm very pleased with, because it shows her with this whole bank of microphones in front of her, testifying before our Senate, and she has a very unfortunate wig it's a wig that she's wearing. Her face looks puffy from radiation treatment. So here she is at the end of her life, suffering greatly, and yet she is speaking truth to power, bringing data into the halls of politics. And out of that came our Environmental Protection Agency and came major pieces of legislation, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and the list goes on, that very clearly trace their roots back to this book, which, after all, was really, narrowly speaking, just about the toxicological properties of 19 pesticides. That's the content of Silent Spring. And yet it was so beautifully written that it awakened an environmental consciousness that went far beyond the subject matter. And I think that's evidence to the power of both her meticulous ability as a scientist, but then her writer's ability to make that come to life in a way that not only made people willing to look at the science, but move them beyond despair into actual activism to change the way things were done and make it better. And by the way, Rachel Carson was able to see signs of climate change as well and wrote about these. She was thinking about this so early on that she didn't have a working model of how carbon dioxide and methane are heat-trapping gases that, you know, they're molecules that vibrate on a certain frequency when struck by thermal radiation. And those vibrating molecules is how heat is trapped in our atmosphere. So she didn't understand why it was happening. But for example, she wrote this: "The evidence that the top of the world is growing warmer is to be found on every hand. The recession of the northern glaciers is going on at such a rate that many smaller ones have already disappeared. If the present rate of melting continues, all others will soon follow." So it was very thrilling for me to discover that she was already struggling with the early signs of climate change, even in the 1950s, and to bring that writing into this collection along with Silent Spring.
You mention this, but you credit Rachel Carson for your decision of leaving the lab and to engage in activism.
I do. Rachel has been part of my life for my entire life and has come in and out of it at various times. So at first, and I'm almost 60 years old, but I would contend I'm one of the youngest people alive that actually remembers when Silent Spring was published in 1962. I was only 3 years old at the time, but my father, who was a lifelong conservative Republican, a man of unchangeable personal habit, and a World War II veteran, read Rachel Carson, and it changed his life. He, first of all, was a teacher at the local high school. He taught business, and he used Silent Spring as his course textbook. So my very earliest memory of this book is seeing the green book with the squiggly lines come out of his briefcase at the end of every working day, and he would lay it on our coffee table. And I began to notice that other grown-ups were walking around carrying the same green book, so I knew it was important. But then, because my father suffered from what we now would call PTSD, from his wartime experiences, he used gardening as a way of his self-medicating and personal therapy. And early on, he adopted what he was told to do by the advertisements of the day, which was to pick up a spray gun and poison the new enemy on the home front, which were the enemies in your backyard.
Right.
But having read Rachel Carson, he was convinced that that was a barbaric thing to do, and so he embraced organic gardening. And I remember the packages of ladybugs and praying mantises coming in the mail. And then soon enough, my sister and I were put to work selling the surplus produce at the end of our driveway, explaining to our customers when they bought our tomatoes what organic meant and who Rachel Carson was. So then she kind of came back into my life later on as a young biologist at the lab bench, who became increasingly frustrated that I could do all this research on the harm that certain chemicals were doing to the environment and publish it, but it would just be sequestered away in the soundproofed scientific literature. And there was a huge disconnect between what we in the scientific community know and the kind of policies that were being made. And it turns out it's nobody's job to bring science into the halls of power and make policy. So I followed Rachel. I read the book again and took a big leap. Left my tenure track biology professor job, reinvented myself as a science writer with the help of a postdoc from Harvard Radcliffe. And as of 1994, I've been making my living as a science writer ever since. So she really planted the vineyards in which I labor. I think that's the expression.
The incredible thing, and I mentioned this earlier, but when you look at it, obviously there is the environmental element, there is the impact that this book continues to have on generations, but the writing itself is just so beautiful. I mean, as an author, as a writer, it is really exceptional.
It's exquisite, yeah. And Rachel was a slow and miserable writer. And in some of the letters I've collected here, she complains to her literary agent and her other colleagues that she wishes she could write faster. So her process involved very slow drafting and then endless revision. She actually wrote like a poet in that she not only uses metaphors and imagery to make it very her writing very visual, but she also made it metrical. And I thought until I read one of her letters that I was the only science writer who was messing around with iambic and spondees and trochaic, you know, all these things you learn in poetry class. Poets create tone and a sense of movement or a sense of stasis, not only using imagery, but of course using metrical patterns and rhythmical patterns in language. And that makes it sing, right? That truly makes it, when you have a rhythm and a beat going, then your reader may not realize that you're writing in Shakespearean line, but it gives it a sense of flow and momentum that just is part of the spell that you can be captured by in really good writing. And she did that too. So she would read everything out loud. When her mother was living and her mother died about halfway through the book, she would read it out loud to her mother. And then she would change a two-syllable adjective to a one-syllable adjective to straighten out the metrical patterns. So again, for me, I'm like an apprentice carpenter who's looking at Carson as the master carpenter, like, how did she do that? And the letters in which she writes about her own writing process is a real revelation. It's like it takes you behind the scenes to see the author at work. So that's why it was so much fun to me to collect her extracurricular writings outside of Silent Spring that comment on how that book was pieced together.
Sandra Steingraber is one of America's leading environmental writers and anti-pollution advocates, a research biologist. She is currently distinguished scholar in residence at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. She is the editor of the new collection from Library of America, Silent Spring and Other Writings on the Environment by Rachel Carson. Sandra, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. I thank you so much for sharing with us and doing this beautiful work.
Well, thank you. And just to kind of give Rachel the last word here, she said in her very last speech that this task to save the Earth will never be ended. We must engage in it with a patience that refuses to be turned aside, with a determination to overcome obstacles, and with pride that it is our privilege to contribute so greatly. Those are words I live by.
Again, Sandra Steingraber is the editor of the new book, Rachel Carson, Silent Spring and Other Writings on the Environment from the Library of America. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.